Welcome to The Rest is Shifty, a podcast highlighting the eclectic legacy of Shifty Records, South Africa's fiercely independent cult record label operating through the dark days of apartheid into the democratic era. I'm Warwick Sony.
And I'm Lloyd Ross. Each episode features a classic album from our catalogue. Today, Mr. Mac and the Genuines. Warwick, do you want to maybe just read the liner notes?
Samuel Mac McKenzie, born in 1924. He's been playing the banjo for more than 50 years in a variety of bands that play Guma rhythms. Big dance bands, klopsa, Kuhn carnival troops, marching bands and jazz bands. The magic of Mr. Mac's banjo is a part of the Cape scene that is rapidly becoming history. On this album, Mr. Mac joins his son, Mac, and the rest of the Genuines in traditional light classics and original compositions to recreate the atmosphere of the annual open-air picnic bush assemblies of Guma bands in preparation for the Kuhn Carnival. So this was written in 1987. Did you write this, Lloyd? Was this who did the liner notes?
I'm not sure who wrote it, Warwick, but I'm pretty damn sure it was before the phrase Kuhn Carnival became a no-go in South Africa.
You know, in 15-something, when the first Englishman passed this way, he was struck dumb. The tip of Africa driving like a knife into the South Atlantic. He called it the fairest Cape in the world.
And I'm also sure that's Mac McKenzie describing the Cape Peninsula, his place of origin, and that of Hilton Schilder, fellow songwriter of the Genuines.
New Age mystics tell me it's a place of great magical power, one of the most important chakra points on the planet. Okay, but for a person like me, this is just home.
I'm sure of that because this is the intro to a film that I made called The Silver Fairs, set in the Malay and minstrel culture of the Cape Flats.
Until the 60s, most of Cape Town's Muslims lived in the city proper. They spoke Afrikaans, a language they helped create, and many had roots that went back centuries. But when apartheid arrived, they were forced to move to the barren flats outside the city. It's a tough world, too little money, too many drugs, and one of the highest murder rates on the planet. Despite this, the people that live here have real geese.
Just before we go on to remind people of who the Genuines are, there are Mac McKenzie on bass guitar and vocal, Hilton Schilder on keyboards, percussion and vocal, Ian Herman on drums, and Gerard O'Brien on guitar. And on this album, of course, featuring Mr. Mac on the banjo, that's Mac McKenzie's father. The reason for the Genuines choosing this very specific sound for their second album, way different from the sound of the first album, was because of their traditional background, specifically Mac's traditional background. Of course, Hilton's as well, although his father was more of a jazz pianist, whereas Mac's father was very much a klops musician. Klops meaning clubs, like in a sporting club, Guma, minstrels, or coons. These are all words to describe the minstrel culture. Although the last one is, of course, deemed politically incorrect. I have to say, though, that whenever filming in whichever community of the Cape, whether it be the Cape metropolitan area where the major minstrel scene happens, or the more minor scene in Wellington, I couldn't help but notice that all the participants of the culture actually referred to themselves as coons.
It's so interesting because, and you and I are both reading Joe Boyd's book, the new one that he's just put out, and The Roots of Rhythm Remain.
But he doesn't mention us.
He could have spent time on this stuff because there's a lot of interesting parallels with this one album to what he talks about with Cuban music. Also, a lot of that Cuban stuff that was breaking huge ground in the world with percussion and all that didn't do well in Cuba. It's often the case. Often it's a working class sound or something that highbrow people don't want to...
Yeah, so it's too sexy for them.
Yeah. And then it finds its way...
And too black.
And too black, exactly. Yeah. And then it finds its way into, you know, some jazz guy's album, and then it becomes a thing.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you've got bongo drums, and you've got claves, and you've got
and the conga
on jazz records in America, mainstream. And so that way it becomes accepted. Hmm. You know, it's a trickle effect. So the Guma thing is so interesting because this was also banjo-driven music. In fact, Joe Boy goes into the origins of the banjo, an African instrument coming from the slaves, and the cross between a drum and a stringed instrument, having the vellum, made it much louder than a guitar and more percussive. So everything the Cubans had and that came from Africa was hugely advanced in percussion, and especially from the way the Cubans worked it. And everything from Europe was harmony-centered. So it was quite an interesting meltdown that happened with the rhythms. And that's the thing with this music, the Guma music. It's very rhythm-based. Those banjos also are percussion instruments.
Oh, yeah.
When you hear them playing.
Primarily.
It's like castanets. So Sam McKenzie, obviously you'd recorded the djembes, then how did it all come about?
Sam, which is Mac's father, Sammy, is a real character. And I think that, you know, when Hilton was growing up especially, he became sort of a key figure around. He had such a great sense of humor. And he was obviously Mac's dad. And I think influenced Mac to a large degree in terms of his music and the rest of it. And as you said, I think in the last podcast, he used to bring records home.
Yes, he worked
because he was a packer in the Gallo.
But it's amazing. I mean, he's such a great player, and it's and what I found interesting was with those ballads, almost classical arrangements.
Moonbeams, for instance.
Yes,
it's a Chopin piece. They just felt they should do an album that paid tribute to his contribution to music.
And it came from them.
Basically, they rehearsed the numbers, got him up from Cape Town. We got into the studio and proceeded with this very interesting kind of ritual every time we wanted to record Mr. Mac. Which included a box of red wine and basically almost a chronometer. You know, so you'd give him a couple of glasses and then start recording. Hilton describes it rather well.
You cannot give him too little or too much. It just had to be balanced. 2.5 glasses and a little off just before he plays. But he clapped it. He clapped the whole album.
But there was a window there. It wasn't as though you could get him, you know, the 2.5 glasses of red wine and then it was fine.
Yeah, no, no.
It was like maybe an hour and a half.
Yes, we had to get him just in the right and say, and Max say, no, you must record him now. He's just right. He's not too wacky and he's not too sober.
And that's the way we managed to get these sessions done.
And did you buy him a banjo?
No. You know the story about the banjo.
I know the story about the banjo. In fact, Hilton told me the story. Samuel McKenzie played, he was a session player as well. He was a very good banjo player and played a lot, but would come home late at night in their small little house and he'd play and keep the family awake.
Max, say, listen, Hilton, you okay, you had a piano player for a father, but at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're all sleeping, you must go to school tomorrow, and your father comes home and the first thing he does is he opens the doors. Everyone would like jump out of the bed, you know, their nerves were fucked. I met banjo. The mother hated the banjo.
Hated it.
And then one day Robert, the Mac's brother, he just made the banjo. It was a Gibson banjo. He made it disappear. He chopped it up into small pieces and buried it in the yard. So many years later, we're digging up the yard there. We kept finding pieces of banjo. And Mr. Mac say, Elton, he used to call me Elton. Elton. I'm just sitting there with Markelem with my banjo. Okay, car. Sure. So we decided now we must buy the old banjo. And he got his dignity back. And he wrote on the banjo, "Who's sorry now?"
So had he not played the banjo then, like for years before he did this?
Well, he didn't have one.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but it's like riding a bicycle.
Yeah, I know, but yeah, I know from guitar, sometimes you have a break and then your fingers are sore. Songs, so it's a good album of, you know, it's quite a lot packed in here.
Yeah, some of them are very short. It starts with a medley, which is Baba Riebop, which is a reference to Jan van Riebeck, who was the founder of the Cape Colony for the Dutch, built the fort and all that kind of thing.
I think the first lyric is basically Jan van Riebeck's penis is limp. Baba Riebop's dung is vim.
Yeah, so vim is a detergent that we used in the Cape.
Literally vim. Is that an Afrikaans word, W-I-M?
No, I think it means vim. It's like, you know, it looked like it's dried white powder.
Yeah.
So I think basically your semen is useless.
So his thing is white powder.
Well, no,
hey, Jan van Riebeck, your thing is white powder. That's the first part.
Is that I had my own interpretations of these, and I find it pretty difficult to let go of the lyric interpretation that I had. And then I suggested that to Hilton, who had a different perspective on it. So it was interesting. And also, Yo Frotta Marti. Niks gemaakt nie. You lay on top, you lay on the bottom, but didn't do anything. So why deny it? When you see the baby in the carriage, it looks exactly like you. So my interpretation of that, and I still stick to the fact that maybe this is the correct one, is that he says he didn't have sex with this woman, but if you look at the baby in the carriage, why does he look exactly like you? But Hilton says that if you look at the baby in the carriage, obviously you couldn't get it together, so somebody else got it together.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So it's a bit confusing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway,
well,
you
it's
know,
the same sort of thing, though. So the baby's not his, either way.
Well, no, the baby is his the first way, definitely. But he just said it isn't his.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But I think, this is, I mean, you can probably talk much more expansively on this, but I think that's the beauty of lyrics, is that you have your own interpretation. And in fact, often the most indecipherable lyric is the one that will stick with you the longest, because you can keep on adding your own interpretation to it. And none of it is wrong.
What I do like is that thing of where people have different interpretations and different stories around them. When Dave Gilmour was asked if they'd written Dark Side of the Moon to synchronize with The Wizard of Oz, he said, of course. Which, I mean, the people who've synchronized it, if you look on YouTube, and it works perfectly, the lyrics and everything, it fits all sorts of places, and it's absolutely fantastic.
So he was just having
Because later on, you know, that's the difference in nature. They asked Roger Waters, and he said, don't be ridiculous. You know, such a grump.
Yeah, he still is.
He still is, yeah. Whereas Gilmour was fantastic. He just said, of course we did.
That's absolutely the correct answer.
It's the correct answer, I say. Just leave the myths, leave people's, my ears are alight. You know, just leave it. Because that's there.
I don't wake up in the morning and then what? After that.
Yeah, no, it's the best thing with lyrics is making up your own. It's like seeing shapes in clouds. And Jamaican lyrics, are, you know, obviously the patois. It's, you know.
It's perfect for it.
Yeah, it's perfect.
And so too with the Cape Afrikaans.
Same with this. So, yeah, getting back to what they call Afrikaans. So the banjo was the thing. What was the history of the banjo in South Africa? How come that? I suppose it would have been an American influence.
So it probably came over with the Christy Minstrels. They did a tour of the Cape in 1862. So they were milking the blackface minstrel fad. It was probably the first time that the word coon was heard in the Cape, but named after raccoon, actually. You know, like a raccoon looks like it's wearing a mask, being the black-white minstrel thing. So they brought with them banjos, definitely, very sort of vibrant costumes, lots of dancing, lots of gaiety, and it appears to have had a very big effect on the Creole and slave classes in the Cape. In fact, something that has lasted until today, with the Cape Minstrels, which used to be called the Coon Carnival. And then 2 years later, in 1864, the Alabama arrived, which was this Confederate ship. And I guess they must have brought banjos as well.
The Alabama came here and it was a huge event. Yeah, everyone, they just loved it. And it was a dreadnought. It was a ship that had sails as well as motors. It was like the Bismarck. It was undefeatable.
Well, they actually sank the Bismarck, but anyway.
Well, they sank the Alabama as well. The banjo originated, though, from, as Joe Boyd said, from the dull-necked Ngoni instrument in West Africa. Here's a few sentences. Africans proved musically adept and were soon pressed into service playing at white dances. European fiddles were...
Where was this?
This was in Cuba.
Cuba, yeah, okay. Probably not much different from what happened in the Cape.
European fiddles were no problem for virtuosos familiar with the savannah's bowed instruments, and by adapting the wood gut and fiber of the new land to recreate the dull Nathan Goni, they invented the banjo. So the banjo was a new instrument coming straight from Africa, and then so it's not a classical instrument in the same way that the violin, for instance, the Western violin was.
Yeah, and then it got transformed in America and then brought back to Africa and the Cape.
I mean, imagine there were tons of banjos at some point in carnival, and because it was a rhythmic device.
You didn't need an amplifier.
Didn't need an amplifier, and you could dance to it.
You could.
Yeah.
You know, whereas with guitar, I mean, you can't really hear those more than a couple of meters away, generally speaking.
It didn't have the vellum. The vellum was what made it loud.
Like yeah, cushion.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's such an intelligent record. You know, the way they're drawn from a music that by then wasn't so hip, the Guma stuff.
Yeah, but they didn't care about that.
But they loved it. It's the culture. So they revamped it into a punk rock kind of speed and with the energy of jazz fusion, everything. Just, you know, the Genuines are great at just melting down everything into a new alloy.
When we did the recording, they wanted to leave quite long spaces in sections of the songs for brass. It just so happened that, because we don't really have money to fly people from Cape Town or whatever, but Robbie Johnson, very, very well-known alto player, used to play with Abdul Imbrum, and Tony Cedros, who ended up living in New York and played with Paul Simon, were in town at the same time, and both friends of Max and Hilton's. And they came in, they did these amazing brass arrangements for us on this album.
Yeah, brass is great.
I'm really happy with the way this turned out. Probably because I didn't use much reverb.
why I use the word punk is it's got to do with that song, O Kleine Janie. The lyrics, its
why
delivery.
Why do you like it so much?
And it's the attitude. No, I love the punk attitude, the fuck you attitude.
Yeah.
You know?
Apparently that's a true story.
Yeah, I was astonished to hear about it.
I mean, names have been changed to protect not so innocent people involved.
Involved, yeah.
This kid was in my mom's class. His name was Abram. I called him Johnny for the youngest. And he was on the farm, you know, my mom did a lot of work with people that were affected by FAS, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome. Yeah. And she was all for getting the guys used to use that old dope system. They used to pay the people in alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, so they wouldn't have to give them money. They would give them a stipend to get food. But they'd spend it mainly on alcohol.
In the store on the farm.
Yeah, but right there by us, you know, Philippi and those places, Skarpkraal and all that, because most of my mom's kids were from there, the kids that she taught. And in this one, like the Abram, his sister asked the farmer for some water, just from water. And he took a hose pipe, put it down and blew his stomach out.
What?
So Abram lost it.
What year was this?
This was...
I mean, was this the 60s, 70s, 80s?
70s. Could be 70, 71, 72, around there, you know.
Anyway,
it was still hardcore. I mean, we just moved into Lotus River, you know. But anyway, this Clyde went mad. He stabbed that farmer 30 times, you see. And then he went on a rampage, you see. And they caught him. He was going to get the death penalty, but then he got pardoned, you know, after they found out the facts and all that. But still, he got like 20 years for it. He was a brave man. He used to get me my weed. And he came out of jail, and it was all... Chappie, he was a 27, he was a hitman, you know what
in
I mean?
In the gangs.
Yeah. And it was like a totally different, it's not the same Abram I knew, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you wouldn't want to trust him.
No ways. In your sleep, actually.
So then you wrote that song?
Yeah, based on that story. Oh, Kleine Janie, hey, go van die plaas.
I like it because it's a story. I love the storytelling and the energy of it.
And the delivery.
The delivery, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just got everything there. Just everything about the Genuines in that song. And it's like Blik is a Boom. It's almost borrowed from the Blik is a Boom song and made a new one. That's what we're talking about, Goomer Without the H. It is a 2.0 version.
So a lot of our music had to do with macabre scenes, right? O Kleine Janie, that he wrote.
Yeah, that is
it's a murder scene.
It's a true story also.
Wherever the oppressor was busy with his slaves and stuff like that, you know? There's a culture. There is a culture of the slave owner, the farmer. When somebody's going to get married, the farmer sleeps with his man's wife.
First preference.
Yes. They just got married, but he's going to have sex with her first. Suki Jackals op die boerseplaas. Bait om Jackals, bait om. Yeah. Now that is euphemism, that is softening the fucking blow. This guy was kicked out of the farm. He lost his job. The farmer was screwing his wife. Took her from him. So he's devastated. And he's out of the farm, he's got nowhere to live and everything. And then one night he comes back to exact revenge. Demands going to the other Fernand. It's a murder scene.
It's a murder story.
A couple more.
Yeah, Hilton's quite a, yeah, he's quite a force on this album, actually.
He Saw Sphere, that's Max's song. He Saw Sphere, Here We Are Again. He Saw Sphere is an interesting song because it's a prison song. So that's when the guy ends up back in Chuki again, back in the prison. And then the way Hilton describes it, that sound that they make, a vroom, 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 to make the work go easier when they're scrubbing the floors. Promotion, I think you'll agree, Warwick, never one of our strong points, was helped in no way by government's control of the airwaves. You know, we had that system of radio where every language was catered to in the apartheid system, so there would be a Sotho and a Zulu and a Pedi and a Tswana station, etc.
But it didn't apply to Cape Town. It wasn't like you got a big investment in a Cape sound. So why was that? There was no... Or was there a Cape Town radio? I don't think there was.
There wasn't really a station for the coloured people in the Cape. The regional station was Radio Good Hope. So we thought, okay, well, let's take this album to Radio Good Hope to see if, you know, they could get the thing out there into the public. But there was a hell of an attitude about it when we got it into the radio station. And I must say, it was actually the coloured people who had the worst attitude to this album. Because I think it was probably, when was this recorded? 87, hey?
Yeah.
Petty apartheid was kind of lightening up at that stage, so there were quite a few progressive coloured people in the radio station. And they saw this as a promotion of the coon, happy native slave culture of the Cape. And so consequently, we got zero airplay again. Talk about the perfect irony. I mean, the SABC wouldn't even allow the ad that we made for this album to be played on the radio because apparently the coloured accent was being mocked. I mean, like really.
Mr. Mac and the Genuines.
Mr. Mac and the Genuines, get it at your record store.
Yeah, man. The LP with the groove.
It's always a difficult one with culture, the thing with apartheid, and whether it's something bad because it was done under the wing and because it survived the apartheid state. For instance, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, you know, a lot of the young comrades and stuff thought that that music and Bakanga and stuff was part of the old guard, and those people, you know, were only survived because they were collaborators. So, you know, this shows the difficulty with cultural things. And artists just play the instruments. They don't really give a shit about politics.
In a general sense, I would agree with you, but certainly not when it comes to the kind of musicians that we feature on the Shifty podcast.
Yeah.
But we did try and produce at least one radio-friendly track on some of the albums that we did. I mean, even with this one. We won't discuss it. The single off the album, as Hilton would say, another of Mac's pumping songs. Just one look, and it's plain to see what's on your mind. Your eyes are telling me powerful things, but we won't discuss it. We won't discuss it, we'll just do it. Pretty obvious. Desperately, another one of Mac's songs, another love song, inverted commas.
Did they ever play this live?
I think they did play once or twice with Mr. Mac live.
Because he came up from Cape Town, so he would have come up for the recording. So consequently, to do a live thing with him must have been quite difficult to organise, unless he did it while they were recording.
Yeah, and then there was that really unpleasant situation that I described in the last podcast about the Genuines and the Guma album, where they played at the University of the Western Cape and basically thought they were going to get necklaced. It was so hectic. Politics and culture often mixed like oil and water.
Yeah, there was this difficult kind of thing with the politics.
Well, there always is.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the Cuba situation. I mean, that was, you know, when I listened to Joe's summary of what happened there, my view of Fidel just plummeted. He never danced a step in his life. What the hell?
He was a boring guy. The instances of him arriving in Mexico, I think, with the revolutionaries there and boring the crap out of them, just droning on into the night, 3 hours of his own voice.
Like Mangosuthu Buthelezi.
Yeah, politicians love to just drone on.
I mean, you just glaze over after a while, right?
Yeah. I mean, Robert Mugabe must have the long. I think he did a 2-day speech.
Well, I think I can beat that. Mangosuthu Buthelezi has the Guinness record for a speech delivered over 11 days. You must have such absolute belief in your own deity status or something. I don't know. What is it? People's impression of themselves. Amazing, yeah. Their egos must be so huge to be able to actually imagine that people are going to be interested.
But anyway, yeah, so it was the thing with the politics, and I know with the Paul Simon thing brought it all to a head, of course, when he came here and when he did Graceland, you know.
Well,
they're good arguments too, you know. His argument is always it's about the music, and music is a leveler. It bridges. Music builds bridges with races, with cultures, with everything. Music's wonderful like that. And that was always Paul Simon's argument.
Yeah, but apart from that,
music brings people together, and
also doing what we were doing in a country that was racially separated. Didn't take long to realize what a great leveler it was. You know,
yeah, exactly.
If you can play, then you're in.
And it made music brought ideas and feelings to people that they didn't know they had. Going back to the Cuban stuff in his thing, the way the infectiousness of the danceability of African music bled its way into quite stiff Calvinistic white people in America. And you could feel it, everything loosening up with blues and rock and roll and gospel influences on what we have today, all the music we kind of love. And that these guys would be playing a music that has its form, actually goes back to the early slave days of Cape Town. And they've turned it around and made it new.
Well, it is the Cape sound. What other Cape sound is there? There's that, and then there's Malay choirs, and the Nederlandslied.
So what's the Nederlandslied then?
Quite an ancient song form, which comes from the days of slavery. You have a very slow beat.
Yeah.
There's no brass in this at all. These days they sometimes have cellos and violins, but guitars and banjo. It's got this incredibly successful mix of Western and Eastern, Wesleyan kind of choir backing, and then this quarter tone Arabic melody that fits over it. As I say, it's quite an ancient song form, so much so that the real traditionalists, or the real sort of sticklers for tradition anyway, don't want any words changed from the original lyric. So much so that there's a lot of people that don't really understand what they're singing.
Yeah,
so they'll use the old,
it's Dutch,
very
high Dutch, yeah.
It's old Dutch, but it's also like Indonesian influenced language, you know, like things are in the Cape. That's what attracted me to make that film, The Silver Fairs, was that sound, because I remembered it from my youth. I don't know how, because I grew up in a white suburb. But we used to go, carnival time, we used to go to the Cape. The Nachtrips used to walk around, and that's what they do. They sing the Nachtrips or the Malay choir.
So Lloyd, you recorded some of these for your movie, hey?
I did, yeah, but I didn't really make an album of them. So they're in the film Silver Fairs. Anybody out there that hasn't seen it, you should. It's a real great introduction to a very vibrant subculture in the Cape.
Christian and Muslim too, weren't they?
They were. So that's another successful thing about it.
You're
talking about the Wesleyan and the Arab quarter tone. And that's an amazing thing about the Cape, actually. There's no problems between Christians and Muslims. Or Jews. I mean, if you remember, District 6 used to have quite a large Jewish population. District 6, by the way, is one of the social engineering projects of apartheid South Africa. So the whole township was just moved to the Cape Flats.
It's amazing. So this used to happen in District 6. It must have made the city so much more vibrant. It's amazing.
District 6 and the Boer Kop. So it used to go between District 6 and the Boer Kop, which is still actually, I mean, that managed to survive, which is incredible, as like a what they used to call a black spot close to the city.
As there's something where people are having fun, those are from the totalitarian side stamp on it. They want to close it down, stamp on it. Sophia Town, at the point where they closed it down, was really happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it was vibrant. There was so much going on.
Yeah, the culture was the just culture, seeping out of it.
People loved it. It was so stimulating.
The whiteys were being attracted into it because it had a vibe, you know, as opposed to the Calvinistic, staid National Party view of the way things should be.
For them, it was a felt fire that they had to stamp on and put out. But that felt fire just pops up somewhere else. Boyd puts it quite well, that same thing in Cuba and across America with rock and roll and blues and jazz and all black music. The conservative stuffy shirt trying to stamp it out because why? It'll loosen the morals and the girls. And
that's
that's what they're worried about, that their woman will run off with the bass player. Actually, the drummer.
Yeah, it's got a big bamboo.
The rhythms were the thing, the rhythms that came out. These are all about rhythms, you know.
But even the slave owners used to realize that you cannot keep the lid on the pressure cooker forever. So in the Cape, the slave owners used to give the slaves a day off the second day after New Year. It was called Tweede Nuwejaar, second New Year. And that's when all the troops used to hit the streets and people used to go out there and play this music. Maybe not the music as you're hearing it on this record, but certainly the roots of this music were made then. This is in the 1800s, before the abolition of slavery. And then after, of course, then it became a tradition. In the Cape, the 2nd of January is still a holiday. Well, it was anyway, during apartheid. I mean, can't remember if it is now.
I don't think it makes any difference.
It doesn't make any difference because nobody goes back holiday. To work until yeah. first week.
No one's going to. It's going to be a holiday, whether it's official or not. One of the things I thought from the Silver Fizz that struck me, one of the most musical moments for me was when, I think it was a room and you set up a mic like this, Lloyd, just in a room this size.
Yeah, that was,
that was amazing.
A goose guitar, a banjo, and Karchi's painting team. And they're singing Boomstraat, which is actually a song by David de Lange.
I think it's a really good moment.
So Boomstraat is about, basically, boom is like marijuana. But, I mean, the authorities didn't recognize that. So that's one of those things where you can actually get messages across because the censors or whatever that are trying to restrict you or stamp things down, they don't really get it. So it just passes and everybody else understands, basically.
Going back to lyric writing, yeah, these are things all over the world, I think, where you've got oppressive governments. I know under Rhodesia there would be songs about the rooster, which represented the liberation movement. And I think even here in South Africa, remember that song, We Miss You, Manilow?
We miss you, Mandela, where are you?
The guy sang it, We Miss You, Mandela.
Yeah. That was a huge hit.
That was a huge hit.
Because everybody understood what he was saying.
Yeah. We miss you, Mandela, where are you?
It was Chico, I think.
It might have been Chico, yeah. So it's quite amusing how you get around it, you know.
The interesting thing about the Genuines albums, every single one was different. If you didn't know, you'd be thinking that you're listening to a different band every time.
Yeah.
The two Shifty albums that we did, which was Guma and then Mr. Mac and the Genuines, are illustration of that. But every single album they did after that, it's the same. They just had such diverse things to draw from. And then Mac went into, you know, after the Genuines, he went into his Guma Captains. And then he went into the Guma Orchestra, where he actually learned how to write music. And he was very taken with the idea of being a serious composer. But then he would keep coming back to that sound. I remember when we did the Shifty 40 Iniquadi Opikopi up the West Coast, him and Hilton. I think it's probably one of Mac's last performances, actually, before he passed away. That's Hilton on the cajon and Mac on guitar. A couple more in Joburg after that, but it was 6 months later that he left the planet. But for the last few decades of his life, it was basically the electric guitar, no longer the bass player. I think you had a quite interesting point about him not wanting to go back to being the rocker, jumping around on stage with a bass guitar, whereas he'd converted to playing the guitar.
Yeah, he took it very seriously, the separation between being a bass player and being a guitarist. It was almost like he'd He was now a guitarist. Don't ask me to play bass.
I always wonder why I refused to play at the Shifty 30 celebrations in 2014. You know, when we brought Ian over from the States.
Yeah, no, he just said it would have taken him too long to have learned all those things, and then he got to get back into the bass again. So yeah, he really did have a sort of thing about it.
That as it may, I remember the primary reason being that he refused to play without his orchestra, or at least his quartet. Yeah, so let's maybe hear from Ian about that time in 2014, you know, when he arrived at the airport and it was the first time that he'd seen his bandmates for like 20 years or something.
Gerard, you know, it was so emotional. I mean, when I saw him, we just hugged and kissed each other so much. And then we had a meal together. And then the next day we were going to go rehearse. And the morning I woke up, I had to pinch myself to think, I'm going to go rehearse with Hilton and Gerard right now. It felt like a dream. And when we started playing, it was so much fun and so cool. Pete's Clear played bass, and Pete has a history with the Genuines, with musicians from Cape Town, because Pete used to play with a group called Estudio, with Russell Herman and Tony Cedros and Robbie Johnson and those guys, who Mac and Hilton and myself, in some ways, the younger generation of those musicians, and Pete had played, you know, so it felt like a really easy fit. But it was frustrating also. I got Nar at one point. But there were just some ridiculous requests. Like Mac's request to have an orchestra, I mean, that one was hilarious. I understand if he hasn't been playing bass in a while, but didn't expect him to even play bass. He's playing guitar. He's an amazing musician. He didn't even have to play. He didn't even have to do anything. He could have just watched TV on the stage. He could have just been there. It was like the last thing in the world I would expect for Mac to say, I'm not coming without my orchestra. But we change, you know.
Yeah, I must say, like Ian, I was also pretty upset. But I suppose it was his decision to make, and I'm sure in retrospect Ian would agree, that's fine. But you remember Gerard's performance at that 2014 30 years of Shifty celebration, Warwick?
It was brilliant.
The Genuine set.
Yeah, it was really brilliant.
I think that he realized this was perhaps the last time he could really put himself out there. And he actually took over from everybody else. In fact, halfway through one of the solos, I saw Hilton doing that sort of cutting throat thing to Gerard. Like, okay, now you can stop your solo. And Gerard just ignored him completely. And he basically was ending up playing guitar, lying on his back on the stage.
Yeah, that's right.
He was saying,
yeah. Really great, though.
A meek guy, always in the shadow of the three other big characters of the band, decided just to go for it.
Me and Hilton were talking in the bar afterwards. We were having celebratory shots. And we were so high, we were floating off the ground. Gerard, we figured it's like if hungry dogs are out and the bowls are put out, Gerard cleaned his bowl and some of the others too. And we were just like, he wiped it clean. Gerard was cutting loose like a wild animal, which was really cool.
Gerard O'Brien!
Okay, on that decidedly non-Gummer note, that's our second Genuines album.
That's the second Genuines album.
With a fifth member, Mr. Samuel McKenzie.
And when did he pass away?
He passed away when he was 70. So Mac was always like, he had this premonition that why should he last longer than his dad? Because, I mean, Mac had, you know, you didn't like sort of,
he didn't turn it down.
He didn't turn it down. In terms of the sex and drugs and rock and roll.
It's that Seinfeld thing where, you know, just work out what's going to kill me and just back it off a little bit.
Yeah, but he didn't back it off. That was the problem. He made it 2 years older than his dad. So his dad must have passed away probably about 12 years ago. No, what am I talking about? That would have made him 12 when he had Mac.
I was going to say.
It was in the 90s. I remember, because I got a phone call from Mac from the airport. He was at the airport. And this is quite typical of Mac. Ach, Lloyd, man, can't you lend me $300? And then he said, well, Sammy's just died and I have to get down to Cape Town. So, of course, Mac, you know. Yeah. But by the time I got to the airport, it was 600 rand. It was also typical of Mac. Such a character.
You've been listening to The Rest is Shifty. For more information, go to shifty.co.za. Or for downloads, find us on shiftyrecords.bandcamp.com.